This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And today we're going to be talking to someone who I think you will find quite amazing, quite interesting, and quite inspiring. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, I will introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Donna Walton. This is Pamela Brewer welcoming you back to this edition of Mind Talk, and I'd like to introduce you to today's guest, Donna Walton. Dr. Walton, how are you today?
Fantastic. Thank you for asking.
Well, fantastic is a great beginning. Now, as you are here with us today, you are a powerhouse of a woman. You've got your bachelor's degree, your master's, you spent your life in school, clearly.
Yes.
Master's and doctorate, you have your own firm, and you are a very busy woman. But this isn't always who you were. So I'd like to start with being really nosy about you as a child. Tell us about your beginnings, where you were born, memorable childhood experiences, aspirations, things like that.
Absolutely. Well, I was born in Washington, D.C. I'm a native Washingtonian, and I was educated in D.C. public school. And I was always a young, I guess, a very curious young girl,
okay.
Very vivacious, very nosy, as a matter of fact, had a keen sense of curiosity.
Nosy is a good thing. I do it a lot.
Yeah, and I always had this somewhat, I guess, innate entrepreneurial spirit. I kind of recall myself always trying to get into something, sell something, do something, or even transform individuals. I remember holding school in my basement where I was the headmaster, of course.
Now, how old were you at this point?
You know, I would say 8 or 9.
Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely. And I do remember when I turned 10, I believe I was off of my fingers. I said, well, okay, now I'm really in charge of some things here.
Okay.
So now I was going to really take control of some things, and I remember hosting a carnival in our backyard, and so I was just always involved. I was just always involved with something, and being very curious about life, and just trying to be just out there, just asking questions and just doing things.
So it sounds like teaching, being creative, that was always a part of who you are.
Always, I guess, the mold of where I came from in terms of just wanting to know more and wanting to exchange that and give other people what I knew. I thought I was a know-it-all.
Okay.
And so I think that part of teaching was always inside of me.
Okay. Well, teachers do have to have some sense of knowing things as well as being able to learn things.
Absolutely.
So take us through, like, junior high school, high school. Was it relatively uneventful, or other than what you were bringing into your own life, or were there any memories that stood out for you?
You know, junior high school was pretty tough because I think that's when you sort of make that transition from now being in an elementary school, if you will, to now you're a junior. And I think that's when my identity was starting to, shift a bit.
Okay.
In terms of how I started to value, you know, view myself. I was very mature. My body was taking on just enormous growth spurts. And so I was very uncomfortable and awkward because I was very large.
Okay.
Not in weight per se.
Okay.
But in development.
That must have thrilled your parents.
I don't know. I know it didn't thrill me because it caused great attention, and I think it did cause my mom some consternation because she understood how. You know,
yeah.
I was a young girl, but yet I was being, you know, viewed as a woman by older men. So I'm sure that was pretty
pretty hard for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just remember those periods of not wanting all that attention to my body parts, if you will, and there was a lot of focus on that. So I would think that was very difficult.
Okay.
And sometimes I didn't sort of match that development. So that was kind of awkward. I was very immature. I mean, I was a patrol girl, and I was in all these activities that were certainly not, you know, developmentally, you know, mature.
Okay.
Girl Scout. I mean, all these things.
Okay.
So, you know, I think that was probably the most I guess, memorable points of my junior high school experience.
So it sounds like you were living your age, just not looking your age.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Take us to high school and college.
Well, you know, high school was not, I didn't really enjoy high school, but I knew that it was very important for me to be, to start that sort of educational trajectory. So I really focused on in school and getting my studies and becoming good at what I good at things. But I didn't really enjoy high school. And in fact, I graduated early.
Mm.
I said, how can I get out of here? And so I remember just having extra credits coming from junior high school because I was involved in all kinds of activities and curriculum. So I was able to graduate early from high school. And I do think, in retrospect, when I think about that, that was part of God's plan, because he was preparing my family and myself for something that was about to lie ahead of me.
You know, what's interesting is that there are lots of children in junior high and high school who are trying to figure out how to get out of there, but they will drop out. You did not choose to drop out. You chose to finish more rapidly.
Absolutely. It wasn't a matter of wanting to, I guess, terminate my education in that respect by dropping out. I think I just didn't feel like I needed to be there anymore. It's like there was something greater out here that I needed to do, and it wasn't in the classroom.
How old were you when you entered college?
Well, I was 16, I believe. I think I was probably 16 when I graduated and left out of Whitson, H.C. Whitson High School in Washington.
I'm going to ask you to speak directly in your phone because I'm losing you in a couple of places.
Okay.
Sure.
Can you hear me now?
I can. You graduated at 16.
Yeah, I graduated at 16.
Okay.
And at that time, I knew that it was time for me to move away, and I was so fortunate to get a scholarship from Point Park College, where I wanted to major in performing arts.
Okay.
And so I left Washington, D.C. at 16 years old.
Oh, my.
Yeah, absolutely, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I majored in this performing arts curriculum.
You know, at 16, to leave home, go someplace else, be in college, I mean, that just sounds really hard.
It was hard, but it was exciting at the same time. But, I think that I do believe that I was being prepared for something else because... Or something was, you know, in preparation, I guess, because it was scary. It was very scary, but at the same time, it was exciting. And I've always had that sense of excitement with me. So it was like, okay, this is wonderful. I'm moving away from Washington. And at a time when not many of my peers were doing that. So that was really, I think, very courageous of me.
Absolutely. Was it easy for you to make friends in your new environment?
Well, let's see. I would say that it was very, it wasn't as easy, I would say, because I was exposed now to a whole different culture of people. And regionally, geographically, it was different in the Allegheny Mountains, per se.
Okay.
So I was fortunate not to really meet new friends in my early studies. But I did end up meeting lots of great friends.
Okay. Tell us what an average day was like as you were majoring in the performing arts. What were some of the classes you were taking? What were you doing?
Well, believe it or not, I started off taking a lot of psychology courses, and I guess that, too, was somewhat by design.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up, you know, actually making that pretty much my later vocation. But I think... the courses were introductory courses to drama and to voice and to all of these things that sort of prepare you to I guess, expose a piece of yourself that you weren't even aware of.
All right, so acting.
They were foundational courses.
All right, acting, singing, those were the things you were doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was exciting. And it sort of got truncated because right at that moment, I was also very much in love. Now, can you believe that? In love with someone back home, and it was a miserable time because I wanted to get I wanted to come back home. I'm like, I don't think I can do this. I miss this person so much.
That you wanted to be back with that person.
I wanted to be back with that person. But again, it was so interesting because all of this was the plan. When I reflect back, this is all about the plan. So I was fortunate to transfer to American University.
Okay.
Where I then began my educational career in terms of elementary education and early childhood.
Let me ask you this though. You went from, and I know something really changed in your life at the age of 18, which we're going to get to after in a few minutes after the break.
Okay.
But you were acting and singing and having a good time, but missing your special someone back home.
Absolutely, because again, that developmental piece, I think, was still not. I think that's part. When I think about it, I wasn't ready. I wasn't really ready to be away from home.
Okay.
And I certainly wasn't ready to experience the overwhelming emotions of being in love at such an early age.
And by that point, you were what, 17?
At that point, I was 17.
Okay.
I'm now 17 years old.
So at 17, you know, it's a rare 17-year-old who isn't completely convinced that he or she has all the keys to all the planets and knows everything about pretty much everything, and that your parents are pretty kind of dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of the hallmark of seven. I mean, your parents start to get dumb probably
mm-hmm.
when you're in your teens, like 12, 13, 14, but by
sure.
17, you're convinced that they're kind of idiots.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They didn't have the answers for that. And they were totally, totally upset with me about that. I remember my mom, I remember that vividly. You know, how could you make such a stupid decision to come back home just because your heart is aching? That too shall pass, as they say. But I wasn't hearing it.
I got you. At 17, you kind of you hear your own voice. So your decision to come back home and to leave your study of acting and singing was about being in love?
Yeah, it was. It was about missing home.
Okay.
And it was about just coming back home, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, when I think about it, absolutely. Because I did not know there was something going on inside of me that was forcing me home anyway.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So like I said, all of these things were, I think, in divine order. I just didn't have a clue. I thought it was because of the boyfriend, but that wasn't it at all.
Okay. So
something was absolutely brewing I was going to have to come home.
So something was brewing that was pretty significant that required you to come home.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Tell you what, we're going to take a break, and we are talking to Donna Walton. And actually, you know what, Donna, we're not going to take a break just yet.
Okay.
We are talking to Donna Walton. My name is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk. Donna, something changed in your life at the age of 18. Can you take us to that day at the age of 18 when you received some information that changed everything for you?
Absolutely. Well, actually, it was the fall of 75.
Okay.
And I was actually still 17
wow.
years old.
Wow. Okay.
When I had transferred to the American University.
So now you were back home.
I was back home.
And were you enjoying school?
Oh, I loved school.
Okay.
I always loved education.
And were you and your boyfriend getting along well?
Yeah, but interestingly enough, that ended.
Oh.
That did end.
Okay.
But yeah, that was going really well and everything. But like I said, there was a shift and that came to an absolute halt. But yes, I came back to American University to pursue my studies. I declared the major of elementary and early childhood education, and I would go to class, but I noticed every day there was this. Well, actually, I played tennis. I should back up a little bit.
Okay.
I was involved with playing tennis, so I would play tennis, and I would go to class, and I would notice that this profound pain was in my leg, my left leg.
Huh.
Right around the knee area. And I just thought, I just sort of, you know, okay, well, maybe this is about playing too much tennis.
Okay.
And my leg just hurts. And I ignored it. So I ignored that.
Now the pain that you were experiencing, was it just as you were playing tennis, or had you experienced it when you were in school earlier?
You know, as I recall, not to that extent, so it wasn't that, noticeable. I remember something, like twitches or something, but
okay.
But nothing to where I would thought anything could possibly be wrong with that would drive me to the hospital to get an x-ray.
Wow, okay. All
yeah.
right, now we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to pick up with the fall of 75 and
okay.
Dr. Donna Walton, who is an extraordinary woman, and you stay tuned. My name is Pamela Brewer. We'll be right back. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer welcoming you back to this edition of Mind Talk as we continue the conversation with Dr. Donna R. Walton. And Donna, we're back in the fall of 75, and you've been enjoying school, you've been playing tennis, little discomfort in your knee, but nothing that you really paid attention to, certainly didn't stop you from doing anything.
Absolutely, until one day, this bright, sunny day in the fall, where I just couldn't take it anymore, and I said, you know, I think I need to go check out this pain in my leg.
Okay.
Because I just couldn't take it anymore. It was just becoming annoying, to where I noticed it every morning, every night. It just wasn't going away.
Was it a constant pain?
It was a constant pain. It was
okay.
A radiating pain, and I thought that it could be somewhat minimized by putting on an ACE bandage. So I would wrap it at night.
Okay.
I would put Gay, salve on it, and that seemed to give me comfort, but only for a very short time.
Interesting. All right.
Very short time. And then it would just come back. So I didn't know. I just thought it was a sprain. So
okay.
I did make it. I went to Sibley Hospital. I'll never forget that day. Sibley Hospital, my girlfriends and I were going to be going to Tyson's Corner immediately after this x-ray.
So Sibley Hospital in Washington, D.C.
Sibley Hospital in Washington, D.C.
And then you and your girlfriend were going to hang out.
And then we were on our way because I'll never forget it. One of our male friends gave us a wonderful Mustang to drive. And I wasn't driving for that long, so this was great. We had a car. We had transportation. We had a direction. We were going shopping to Tyson's Corner. And at that time, that was a premier mall because
Tyson's Corner in Virginia, absolutely.
Absolutely. That was and it was far away. Because now, although I'm in Washington, D.C., I'm starting to explore areas of Washington that I existed.
Okay.
So that was just really like, wow, this is going to be a great day.
Okay.
We are going to Tyson's Corner Mall, but first we must get this leg checked out.
Okay.
It's just annoying. So I remember going into these hallow halls of this hospital, and it was very, very quiet, very stealth, and, having the x-ray, and then was placed in a wheelchair, and I remember telling my friends later. I said, "Wow, this is a great hospital. They really carry you around and everything."
Mm-hmm.
But at this time, when the reason why they were placing me in this wheelchair is because when they had taken the X-ray of my leg,
uh-huh.
they knew that the what they saw, they had to take a chest X-ray.
Oh.
So because that is the sort of mainstream or the travel of this particular cancer that, of course, later discovered that I had.
So the pain, the radiating pain in your knee was cancer.
The radiating pain in my knee was cancer. Now, at the time, they did not mention the word cancer.
Okay.
They called it a growth.
Okay.
They didn't even say tumor. They just called it a growth.
Okay.
Because this was pre-biopsy.
Okay.
So they didn't make that sort of diagnosis. But, you know, that's what it was. So it was a matter of getting this X-ray and seeing this, and they called me into this room and put the X-ray, you know, on the light. And at this time, my parents were not there.
Okay.
And I do recall we were going through quite a bit of questioning of, you have something in your, you have a growth in your bone, and I said, okay, let's take it out.
Uh-huh.
And I remember them saying that it's not that simple, that you just don't take it out. And then I do recall them mentioning Edward Kennedy Jr. as an example, and I didn't understand that connection.
Okay.
At the time.
Okay.
But I do remember that being mentioned, and that was odd. But then at this time, I think, use the expression, but all hell broke loose.
Uh-huh.
Because my mom arrived at this time.
So they called her, or you called her?
I think they called her.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I wasn't talking to anyone. I mean, they had me sequestered in
okay.
the room, and the next thing I know, because I think they knew the chain of events that were about to occur.
Gotcha.
And it had to move pretty quickly. So I do remember my mom arriving, and she at the time was introduced to a Pentecostal faith, so she had her minister with her, or I think they called him the bishop then.
Okay.
And they arrived, and things got shut down. In that, I think that she was adamant about them not giving me any more information. Do not talk to me about what I was talking to her about.
Okay.
So let's just shut that down. And I remember leaving in a very inebriated state. I mean, just they had given me this pill.
Uh-huh.
And I was just, by this time, I was drunk. I mean, high, done. Oh. I was out of it. And I do remember leaving with not a diagnosis, but knowing something.
Something was wrong.
Something was wrong.
So much for Tyson's Mall that day.
So much for Tyson's Mall that day. That became all a nightmare. I think that's when it became now a nightmare. My dreams were now literally turning into a nightmare.
I'm going to ask you to continue to try to speak directly into the
sure.
into the mouthpiece. All right. So your mom arrived and wanted you to have no more information. So the information was, I guess, transmitted to your mom and her minister.
Absolutely, and I don't know to what extent was transferred to her.
I
to this day I don't know
okay.
what was said to her, but obviously she knew because the word cancer did not come up until after my biopsy, until after the biopsy was, I guess, confirmed that it was osteogenic sarcoma.
Huh.
That the word cancer actually kind of filled the room. And at that point, when I was at the George Washington Hospital, where I had the... Well, actually, I skipped because I got ahead of myself here.
Okay.
Because it was a little more dramatic than leaving Sibley, because now we're in October of 1975.
Okay.
And actually, the biopsy did not occur until March. January of 1976.
Why so long?
Because family and I went into absolute denial. We
okay.
left that Sibley Hospital.
Okay.
We shut it down. There was not going to be any more mention of a leg being amputated, which was the course, I'm pretty sure of what my mom was being told.
I
was not told that.
Okay.
But clearly there was something that I was not going to be dealing with. And I certainly didn't want to deal with it, so it sounded good to me.
Okay.
So we all just went into complete denial.
Now, what about the pain?
The pain was persistent. Pain did not go away because I left that hospital.
And did they give you anything for the pain?
Well, at that time, I was set up to come back to have the biopsy.
Okay.
But we never went to have that biopsy until events caused me or forced me to have the biopsy.
What were those events?
Well, I was boarding a Metro bus at Lafayette Square on this frigid day.
And that's Washington, D.C.?
And Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And my leg literally snapped in half when I boarded this bus.
Your leg snapped in half?
My leg snapped in half. And if I can recall that pain, and that's why it's amazing how when you're trauma, how you manage trauma.
Yes.
I was traumatized. And all I can remember is the pain being so excruciating that I screamed. I just remember screaming so loud that's all I remember. And then all lights were out.
I would think so.
All lights were out.
I would think so.
I don't remember. I mean, it was just that traumatic. I think this day when I recall that, I get phantom pain recalling it.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how when I can recall that event, even today, 37 years later, I have phantom pain in my residual limb because the pain was just enormous. It was just, I don't think anyone could even describe the pain.
It sounds breathtaking. I mean, literally breathtaking.
And it was. And I remember the ambulance coming at that point to take me George Washington Hospital, and that's when all events start to really unfold and unfold rapidly.
I would think so. And so you were getting on the bus. Where were you going to?
I was going home, actually, because I was fortunate to have a stay-in-school program with the federal government.
Okay.
So I was leaving the Veterans Administration.
Okay.
From my job, and I was going back to, I think I was living at home at this point. I think it might have been the semester break.
Okay.
So I was living at home. And so that was the event. That was the event. And I did not make it home that day. I went straight to the hospital.
Now, at this point, you're how old?
At this point now, I'm 17.
You're still 17?
I'm still 17. That's October of 70. Well, it's actually January. I didn't turn 18 until April.
Okay.
Yes.
17, and your leg breaks in half.
It breaks in half. It was a compound, I'll never forget, it was a fracture through a tumor. That's how they described it. It was the most unusual medical phenomenon at the time. Because, mind you, this tumor has now grown into a size of a grapefruit.
Oh, my.
So my leg had, and I was going through this. I mean, that's why I know how denial is powerful.
Indeed, indeed.
Because my leg literally had a different form to it. So this cancer was growing, and my knee literally was larger than my right knee. So it was incredible, but I guess the idea of keeping a diseased leg seems so much more rational than having an amputated one.
Well, yeah, you'd have two legs, and so what? That you were in extraordinary pain, you'd still have two legs. I mean, that's kind of the world we live in.
Absolutely.
Where looks often trump a whole bunch of stuff.
And they do. And they do. And at all costs, you want to hold on to that sense of normalcy.
Yeah. All right, folks, my name is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and you're listening to The Life of Donna Walton. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. And, Donna, when we come back, I'd like to start with talking to you about your sense of normalcy, what that meant to you then and what it means to you now. We're going to take a break. Welcome back. This is Pamela Brewer. We continue our dialogue with Donna Walton. Donna, just before the break, I asked you to talk about your sense of normalcy. It was one thing before you stepped on that bus, and then it was something very different after your leg broke in half.
Well, of course, now that I have this deformed leg, because the leg was actually useless, now that it was in a fractured state, then, of course, events had to ensue where I had to have the amputation. But interestingly enough, there's still a lot of events that happened in the middle that this amputation did not occur until March of 1976. From January up until March, the events of still denial and trying to find a cure, if you will, trying to find answers that my mom could accept, because, again, as I mentioned earlier, she was very much involved with the Pentecostal faith and anything outside of healing, God's healing, was unheard of.
Okay.
So at every cost, there was about trying to find the healing, trying to find a way by which her child would not have to lose her leg. But all this time that the parishioners and everyone else were making these decisions about me keeping my leg, I was having my own prayer revival and my own spiritual journey was happening, to where I was starting to move towards more of normal, if you will, would be out of pain. Normal would be being free, and that the diseased leg, in fact, was what was holding me back from being this person, I guess, that I was now supposed to become.
I see.
So I would say my journey towards normal, to reach normalcy, sort of began right at that point of when the acceptance of when I had to have my leg amputated. That was the journey of normalcy, and I had to now want to think of myself, in order for me to sort of get this paradigm of normalcy, I had to visualize myself, and I mean visualize myself with two legs. I always saw myself with two legs. I dreamed with two legs. I saw myself dancing, the movement, and I'm very much today still fixed on legs, and I think that's how my whole company name, Leg Talk, became into existence. I'm very much fixed on the leg, the form of the leg, the movement of the leg. I'm very much fixated on that, that imagery, because it was that leg that was going to define me. It was all about this leg that was going to be the defining part of my life, that I had to somewhat overcome to realize that it was not, it could not be the centerpiece of my life. It could not be the centerpiece. So establishing this normalcy was basically not, I didn't want to adhere to the images that I had seen of amputees. I did not want to, I always wanted to wear my prosthesis. I never wanted to use my crutches and have my pant leg sort of slip behind. I never wanted to do that. I never wanted to use a wheelchair, which was the mode of transportation, if you will, at the time. It seemed like the paradigm of rehabilitation was more about being dependent as opposed to being self-sufficient. So it really wasn't a good piece psychologically for me, because the world around me was trying to make me disabled, whereas I was trying to change the shift my thinking and visualizations to being very, non-disabled.
Differently abled, certainly.
Differently abled, if you will. I didn't even subscribe to the word disabled, crippled. Those terms, handicapped, they really cringed me, and they still do today. But I know now. I mean, I've grown so much that the word disability doesn't really affect me that way. Because I know it's important to subscribe to something that. In terms of policy and in terms of being recognized and getting certain provisions, you have to subscribe to that. But it doesn't define me by no means.
The removal of your leg. What do you remember the day after the surgery?
Somewhat. I do recall waking up in the recovery room and placing my hand over my residual limb and feeling this absent space, just this absent space, and at that point realized it was really gone. It wasn't like what I had seen in different movies or whatever in terms of an amputated limb. My leg was very, very, they had to amputate very, very short. If you can visualize, I guess about a 2-inch femur, is probably what they had, was remaining after my amputation. So a very, very short amputation. With respect to wearing a prosthesis, a very, very difficult amputation.
I would think so.
Very difficult amputation. It really caused me most of my troubles today. It still does. But at this point, that establishing normalcy, I don't strive now to have this perfect gait, to have this perfect ambulation. I've come to terms with this is how I walk. I walk with the limp. I use a cane, and this is my normalcy. This is it.
Okay.
And I'm okay with that. But for decades, I would struggle with trying to walk normal, so no one would detect anything.
Okay.
But that was always going to be the challenge because of the nature of my amputation. So I was never going to achieve that goal, although prosthesis would always convinced me that I could, but there were just certain limitations that I would never be able to reach.
You know, I'm thinking about the huge shift from the person you saw yourself as moments before your surgery to the person you then began to see yourself as moments later. At some point in your material, you say that life is intricate in each part is like a piece of a puzzle, and your self-image controls it all. What were some of the puzzle pieces going on as you worked towards being who you are today?
Well, the aspect of my womanhood, my femininity, all of these things were being challenged. They were just being challenged. Because now the way I actually want it to look, I had to really transform myself to get to that stage because society was very much a lookism society.
Yes.
It was all about how you look in your clothes and how, how I looked and felt in my clothes and the attention that I would get because the prosthesis is very awkward. In your clothing, and so trying to find this right way, I was always on the quest of being this diva. I was like, at all costs, I will look good. So
and you
I
do.
Would find ways. I found a great cobbler who would get these shoes the heel height just right, so that I could walk in these great, fantastic shoes. Because when I left rehabilitation, the prescription at that time was hush puppies, and I'm not downing hush puppies.
I understand,
but hush
they have
puppies
their place.
For me was not my look.
Okay,
it was not my look.
Okay, your look was heels.
My look was definitely heels.
Diva.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because at this time, you have to remember in the 70s, this was platform time.
Oh, that's right.
So I had to leave my platform and go down to a hush puppy? No way. That was traumatizing enough.
That was not happening. Gotcha.
No, I couldn't do that. Just finding ways, I think I spent a lot of years, just finding, just to get my look right. The right clothing that would mask the bumps and the humps and everything like that. So I spent a lot of years. And it took me 10 years. Before I wore a dress. I didn't wear a dress for 10 years
for 10
after
years.
My amputation.
Huh.
I just could not fathom the look of this prosthesis in a dress. So wearing pants was my mode. I mean, I loved wearing pants or pantsuit or anything that would mask
Okay.
And but it was 10 years later that I moved to Houston, Texas, by the way, because I knew that I needed to get away because the perceptions alone were killing me.
What do you mean? What?
How other persons perceived me was much more damaging for me at this time because I need to recover. I need to recover and rejuvenate and get this new me going, this new normalcy going, and I couldn't do it with the eyes staring me in Washington, D.C.
So how were people perceiving you? How were you being treated?
Very, very much poor Donna.
Okay.
Poor Donna. It was always a poor Donna kind of mantra. Even though, and they were, it was always so interesting because they were always a poor Donna, but you're still pretty.
Wow.
It was poor Donna, but.
Okay.
You know, so you know, I was always reminded, always constantly reminded by this,
how
I looked, and but you know, and how could this happen to you?
What was your mother doing with this? You talked earlier about your mother being Pentecostal. What did she do with the fact of the amputation?
Well, you know, when my mom at this point, I made the decision to have my amputation. It was my decision to call in the physicians. I'll never forget the day. I said, okay, it's time. This is I had a serious talk with my mom, and at this point, I think she had seen me suffer enough. And I think maybe she was even having some cathartic experience about everything because she was in turn saying, you know, you're 18 now, so you can make that decision. If that's what you if that's what you want, then you know, you move forward.
Okay.
And as soon as I got that, and I think it was going to be done regardless. I don't know how it was going to happen, but I knew it was going to happen. I was going to live my life now as an amputee, and I was okay with that.
Okay.
So, you know, she came to acceptance.
Okay.
She came to acceptance, and I think at that moment when she came to acceptance, my world really started to open up because now. I definitely didn't get the poor Donna from her.
Okay.
I definitely didn't get that from my family.
Good.
I can say
that
because of where we, you know, where we had to live. I mean, we lived in an apartment at the time, so I had to do stairs.
Okay.
There was just no way I was going to get around it. It's where we live. So things kicked in very rapidly. In terms of adjustment,
okay,
and there are two major constructs to disability in terms of amputation, I should say.
Okay,
and that is you know adjustment to the disability and acceptance of the disability.
Yes.
And I think that those two things were happening to me. I mean, they weren't happening to me simultaneously. That's for sure, because the acceptance came much later.
Okay.
The adjustment had to come. I think the adjustment came faster. Acceptance came a little later.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You moved out of state, though.
I did. I moved to Houston, Texas. I remember I had gotten my bachelor's degree, and I was ready to teach, and I wanted to do this outside of people watching me.
Gotcha.
I wanted to have a new stage.
I got that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to Texas.
You're going to Texas.
Okay. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and to the story of Donna Walton. Don't go away. We'll be right back. taking us to Texas.
Houston, Texas.
Tell me what that was like.
Well, that was interesting. That was interesting, but it was extremely revealing. I think that my self-concept became alive. Because, again, I moved to Texas to get this whole new view of, well, I guess for others to have a view of me as I showed up, if you will.
Okay.
I didn't have to explain anything anymore.
Okay.
It was wonderful that I was able to just go to this new state and didn't know anyone. I did have a family friend who lived there, and that's what prompted me to get there. And I actually told a major lie. I mean, it wasn't even a white lie. It was a major lie. I said I had a job.
It all comes out.
I told my family that I had a job, family and friends. I found a job in Houston, so I am moving. And in actuality, I didn't have a job at all.
Okay.
And this is the time that I knew I could get a job because I was a very skilled teacher and I was good at my craft, even though I was just beginning my journey in education, teaching. I was good and I knew I could get a job. But interestingly enough, my major was elementary early childhood education, but I was always, when I went to apply for jobs in the school district of Houston, I was always tagged for special education, and that was very revealing at the time.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Very interesting. I was always tagged to teach special education. Now, it concerned me later it didn't concern me right away because I thought it was kind of like an honor in a sense. It's like, wow, this is really going to be a good thing.
Okay.
But it really wasn't a good thing because my training was about elementary, general education, if you will. But I was being perceived right at that moment when I was being offered jobs in special education. I realized then that was being projected for me.
Right.
And so that was extremely telling, and it didn't work well.
Okay.
But for a while, I adopted that, and I really kind of believed that that's where I needed to be.
Okay.
And I started to get comfortable in that space, and that wasn't good because it became normal now. It's like, okay, now I could be around sort of people like me,
I see.
And that wasn't the identity I was trying to go for.
Okay.
But that took a moment for me to catch on to that. Because I was very committed to education, and I was very committed to student learning. So it kind of trumped that. That part kind of trumped what I was really perceiving as not being a good thing for me to be in a special teaching special education, because it was more about me as opposed to me teaching those students. So Texas was very good for me.
Okay.
Because it exposed me to some things that I really hadn't thought about myself. And that's where I actually got a chance to explore my whole body concept, if you will.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I showed
my prosthesis a little more.
You did?
Yeah, I did. I was me. I just showed up.
You were doing you.
I was doing me on a stage that, okay, this is great. I have an audience that no one knows me. So the way I show up, this is it.
Now, let me ask you this. I mean, you've used the word lookism. I mean, the way that this society takes how you look and makes it something, it may be true, maybe not true. A lot of focus on how you look. And certainly how you look gets focused a lot on in dating. So tell me about dating. Were you dating at that point?
Dating was tough. Because it was all about the torso for me.
Mm-hmm.
As long as gentlemen, men, saw me torso. I mean, when I was driving I got the most attention driving my car. Now, I always had a sports car. I loved it.
Okay.
So the attention was unbelievable. I mean, men were everywhere because they saw this attractive torso.
Okay.
Face. You know, these shoulders, I suppose.
Okay.
And hands.
they saw the diva.
That's correct. but they did not see the fact that I walked with a cane.
Okay.
Until I would actually have to get out of my car.
Okay.
And that And that would seem like that would always have to happen some kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to get out. I'm like, oh, no, I have to get out. Because this was during the time fortunately, you didn't pump your gas. You stayed in your car a lot because you have others pump your gas. So that worked out really well a lot. Then I had to get out my car. But later, when you had to get out your car, that was really painful, having to get out to pump my gas and have to walk. That's when men really saw, okay, everything was fine, mm-hmm, as long as my prosthetic was on. I noticed that men were great,
okay,
with the idea that something's going on, don't know quite what it is.
Okay.
Okay. Maybe it's a broken leg, a broken foot.
Okay. Maybe never it's temporary?
Temporary, absolutely.
Okay.
But never permanent and certainly never an amputation.
Gotcha.
So as long as I could mask that conversation, I was fine. But immediately that conversation came up, what happened to you? And that question always, it bothers me still today. What happened to you?
Mm.
It's most amazing to me that I can walk into a room sometimes, and then persons don't even try to get to know my name, but the first thing that comes out of their mouth is, what happened to you? That was a bad message.
Absolutely.
Constantly hearing that. So body image was about being normal, if you will, being feminine, and men are very visual.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as they could understand you being, you know, attractive without, you know, with a prosthetic on, they were fine. But as soon as that prosthetic was removed,
not fine.
And I had a boyfriend who I dated in high school. I never forget him. And then dated him after high school. And I remember he was always so comfortable with the leg on. It's like, oh, this is great, leg
okay.
on. But immediately when I tried to take my leg off, because for comfort purposes, it was
right.
very uncomfortable.
Right.
He would panic. He would really, really panic. And he would say, I have to go. Don't take your leg off.
Wow.
Don't take your leg off. Because now my mode is hopping and not walking. It's,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's new. And not many people were around amputees. I mean, I was the first of my, you know, peer group, certainly, to have a disability, if you will, have an amputation.
Okay.
So I exposed individuals to things that they weren't really ready to see.
Speaking of legs, let's jump really forward and talk about your company, Leg Talk.
Yeah. Well, Leg Talk was just born out of that whole idea, as I said. I noticed that the change that was occurring when I met individuals, or my teaching and all the things that I was doing in my life, in my career, that change was taking place with people when they talked.
Mm.
And when they talked about what's bothering them,
uh-huh.
if you will. So that led to me going to get my doctorate, actually, in rehabilitation counseling.
Huh, okay.
And out of that, I was doing a lot of motivational talks and a lot of coaching, and then I decided, you know, this is powerful here. I need to do something with this, but let's do something. So this leg, I established the acronym for leg. It was spelling it with two G's,
mm-hmm.
being lessons of empowerment for achieving goals and greatness. Because I felt that that's what people were. It just wasn't about achieving a goal. Because I was very good at helping individuals with their career planning,
mm-hmm.
and getting them to where the next step in their career. But it was about not just achieving a goal, but becoming great at it.
And
great.
And not solely for persons with disabilities.
And solely not for persons with disabilities. Because
okay.
I found out that
okay.
it was persons with non-disabilities who had the amputated spirits that I was working with most.
Interesting.
And so that was interesting. And, in fact, that was pretty much most of my clients were persons with non-disabilities, even though my focus was to really help individuals with disabilities, you know, overcome their deficits, if you will, and live their life powerfully. It was really mainly women, if you will, without disabilities, who found that they, in turn, were the ones with the amputated spirit.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to ask you in the few moments that we have left just to share. I know you're working on a book.
Yes, yes.
And I am going to ask you to give folks contact information so they can take a look at your website and
sure.
learn about Divas with Disabilities and all of that. But if you would just read a little bit from the book that you're working on?
Absolutely.
Okay,
well,
go for it.
I'll do that. There's a paragraph here that I could share. It says, ultimately, my story became one of power and purpose, and I was able to create the story out of the raggedy pieces that were left after my life was shattered by illness and disability. Now, this is how I knew it is possible to author a new narrative as many times as necessary, as many times as you need to. I had to do this at those times when people called me out of my name, when men rejected me, and when people made unfounded assumptions about my abilities, my intelligence, even my sexuality. My refusal, though, to allow my self-esteem to be murdered by negative thinking and self-defeating thoughts, whether they came from me or from someone else, connected me to a wellspring of power. Tapping into that source within, I aligned my true self and dared life to not let me live it.
Amazing. Extraordinary. Thank you so much. Donna R. Walton, and I'm going to ask you to make sure that I get a copy of that completed manuscript because I got to read the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You got it.
Donna Walton, would you let us know how to be in touch with you?
Absolutely. Very simply. You can reach me in two ways. You can go to divaswithdisabilities.com.
Okay. divaswithdisabilities.com.
Absolutely. All one word.
Okay.
And you can also go to LegTalk with two G's, LegTalk.com.
And I will make sure that information is on the Mind Talk Facebook page as well.
Absolutely. I thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to talk with you and to meet you, and I hope that we will be in touch very soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
All righty. You take care, Donna. Thank you.
Goodbye now.
Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you have been listening to this edition of Mind Talk and to this edition of A Life of an Extraordinary Woman who has walked us through her path, her journey, her pain, and her survival, and her reemergence, and her own magnificence. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown for 26x2 Productions. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286, 301-654-5286. The email address is mindtalk, M-Y-N-D-T-A-L-K, at AOL.com. The website is mindtalk.com, and we're on Facebook and Twitter, so there are all kinds of ways for you to be in touch. You take care, and remember, if it's unacceptable, then it is unacceptable.